Meanwhile, First Lady Hillary Clinton calls the coverage of the intern sex scandal a vigorous feeding frenzy. In an interview on NBC's Today Show, she blamed the allegations against her husband on a mean-spirited right-wing political agenda. Meanwhile, the Whitewater prosecutor today is mulling over an offer of cooperation from Monica Lewinsky in exchange for immunity. Sources say she's ready to testify she had sex with President Clinton, something Clinton denies. Her scheduled grand jury appearance has been postponed indefinitely while prosecutors mull her request for immunity. Monica Lewinsky reportedly met privately with President Clinton in the White House late last month. The New York Times says the visit occurred even though administration officials previously had ordered that her access be restricted. The Times quotes a former White House official and an associate of Lewinsky. It says the meeting occurred 2 weeks after Lewinsky was served a subpoena ordering her to provide information in the Paula Jones case. Yesterday, President Clinton adamantly denied having what he called sexual relations with that woman. But later, a reporter asked Mike McCurry about that word sexual relations, saying it was defined in the dictionary as sexual intercourse. And he asked if there was any other kind of sexual relations. Mike McCurry refused to answer. A Pentagon official says if an attack is ordered against Iraq, it won't be a pinprick. The Clinton administration is laying the groundwork for a possible strike, alleging that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein may still be able to make weapons of mass destruction. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Richard Butler is quoted as saying that Iraq has biological weapons enough to, quote, blow away Tel Aviv. Administration officials have briefed U.S. allies and congressional leaders on a possible attack, and the response has been favorable from Republican leaders, including House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Meanwhile, the White House continues to deny that President Clinton would use an attack to shift attention from allegations that he had sexual relations with a former intern. Russian President Boris Yeltsin, angered by what he considered the needless intensification of tension between Iraq and the United States and responding to domestic political considerations, dispatched a special envoy to Baghdad. Meanwhile, Brazil released a report saying that destruction of the Amazon rainforest nearly tripled between the start of the decade and the 1994-95 burning season. The destruction surpassed the worst years of deforestation that caused an international outcry to save the rainforest. This news from The Hague. A Bosnian Serb who calls himself Adolf pleaded innocent yesterday to genocide and other charges, denying prosecution claims that he killed scores of Muslims in 1992 and then bragged about it. Joram Jelicic, appearing before the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal, called the charges all lies and fabrications. Prosecutors say Jelicic systematically shot Muslims to death at the Luka camp in northern Bosnia in 1992, then ordered fellow inmates to collect the bodies. Jelicic, a camp guard, allegedly identified himself as the Serb Adolf, referring to Hitler, and boasted about how many Muslims he killed. At yesterday's hearing, Jelicic told the UN court, "My name is Joran Jelicic. I am also known by my nickname, Adolf." And this news from London, the party representing Northern Ireland's largest pro-British paramilitary group withdrew from peace talks yesterday. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A black-owned weekly newspaper in Jackson, Mississippi, known for its investigations and battles with local officials, was firebombed early Monday in an attack the publisher said reminded him of civil rights-era harassment. The bombing left the newsroom a charred shell. Flames melted the computers and cameras. The damage was estimated at $100,000. Investigators are testing wicks from two Molotov cocktails apparently tossed through the newspaper's front window or door. Charles Tisdale says his office has been vandalized or bombed more than 20 times since he took over the 58-year-old Jackson Advocate in the late 1970s. He said an anonymous caller Friday night threatened to kill him. He joins us now on the line from Jackson. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, at 3 o'clock, I received a notice from the Detective Agency and Alarm Service that my office had been, that the alarm had gone off in my office. That happens frequently, so I took my time and got dressed and drove to my office. And there I found it in shambles and burned practically to the ground. for all practical purposes.
Well, what happened? How did it burn down?
Well, according to the authorities, someone came in, poured gasoline all over the floor, and then threw in a firebomb, a Molotov cocktail, to ignite the gasoline on the floor.
Do you have any suspicions about who this might be?
Well, I think it's some people who are busily privatizing the city and privatizing everything else in sight.
How unusual is this for you?
Well, this is the 21st time I've been shot at, vandalized, or otherwise.
What do you mean, shot at?
Well, shot at. One time some Klansmen came in and, well, didn't come in, but they stood outside my office and shot in 385 times with submachine guns.
When was this?
This was in about 6 years ago.
Were they arrested?
Yes. And sentenced to one was sentenced to 5 years and the other, I believe, to 7 to 15 years in prison. They got out in 8 months and 10 days. They were released in 8 months and 10 days.
Tell us a little more about the issue of privatization that you've been covering. What is being privatized in Jackson, Mississippi?
Well, everything is being privatized, from the sewage systems to the whole city itself. The group who's doing the privatizing calls itself Capital Center Incorporated, and it wants to take over every space, every public space, and really basically run government and eliminate elective government. And we had hearings in the city council on, I believe it was July the 11th, 1995, voted not to do any kind of business with Capital Center Incorporated. And subsequently, new councilmen were elected in a combination of new city council people. And then the state auditor told them that if they didn't vote a retroactive contract for this group, that they would be forced to pay something like $100,000 themselves to cover the cost of an illegal contract given them by the mayor. The city council people did not know that what they were voting on, so the mayor injected this $100,000 that he gave to this privatizing group to do what they wanted to do in taking over the city. And the state auditor, who enforces the codes that cities live by, told them if they didn't vote to retroactively approve a contract for Capital Center Incorporated, that he would make them pay the money back themselves and go to jail and that kind of thing.
Is the Jackson Advocate covering this extensively?
Yes, we have been fighting it extensively. In fact, we filed a lawsuit which will be heard within the next 10 days against Capital Center and the mayor at that time and certain of the city council members because of no retroactive contract is worth the salt it's written on. But the biggest danger is that they want to take over practically all of downtown Jackson, 84 blocks, and the city would thus lose control of that. I mean, the mayor couldn't vote on it. The city council couldn't vote on what happens in that 84-block area.
Do you consider this a racial issue?
Of course it is, because only four black people can vote on it. The governing body of Capital Center Incorporated only has four black people on it.
And how many white people?
I think there are about 30 or so.
What makes you believe that they firebombed you?
Well, I didn't say that they firebombed me. You asked me who was I suspicious of, and that's who I'm suspicious of. because they've done everything else to me. They've called my advertisers and even gone to city council gone to city council members and asked them to help them to start another newspaper so that they could put me out of business.
Can you tell us a little about the issues that the Jackson Advocate has taken on over the years and the various reasons you've been firebombed through the 60s, 70s, 80s, now 90s?
Well, the first thing was opposition to voting rights. The local newspaper, the Jackson Daily News and Clarion Ledger, wrote an editorial that said if the Jackson Advocate didn't quit agitating for voting rights, that there was going to be a lynching in the middle of Ferris Street, and the editor of the Jackson Advocate was going to be right in the middle of it. Then came the assaults related to economic self-determination. The local paper supported our not having enough advertising to survive, and that went on for a while. Then came the issue of the modern period, voting rights, where the Voting Rights Act of 1965 placed our people in position to really gain authority, like Fannie Lou Hamer and others of that ilk, and we supported them. And, of course, the chairman of the Jackson Advocate at that time was Dr. Aaron Henry, who died last year and who ran for governor of Mississippi long before it was possible to really be effective in that role. But as a consequence, the radio stations, the television stations, and nobody else would give him time to run his campaign. And so he took WLBT, a big television station in Mississippi, the largest, the court, for refusing to sell him time. And eventually he won. The station was sanctioned, and Dr. Henry became the chairman of the board of WLBT, and it is now a black-owned station, one of the largest in the country. We carried on the, I think I talked to you about the death in jails that was occurring in Mississippi in 1992, and everybody was upset about that. And then we carried on crusades against African-Americans who were elected to office by black voters and turned their backs on them, which is occurring a good deal now. On the welfare bill that I just referred to when I was talking to you, only three blacks abstained from voting for it, who were Representatives Jim Evans and Tommy Green and Mary Coleman. And the privatization of resources of the state is being steadily supported by African Americans here. But this is happening all over the country, really. I think in Tennessee, the Black Caucus has voted to support a prison privatization to a greater degree than any other state in the union. And that's dominated by the so-called black intellectuals in Tennessee.
Is that an issue in Mississippi as well, in Jackson, privatization of prisons?
Two prisoners were just killed up in Holly Springs at the private prison there, and there has been no sufficient investigation. And NACP basically has dwindled to nothing since Dr. Henry left his post as director for 4 years ago. He was a member, the oldest member of the group that challenged President Johnson for voting rights at the Democratic Convention in 1964. He and Fannie Lou Hamer and Eunita Blackwell were the leaders of that delegation.
Mr. Tisdale, what are your plans now? How badly damaged is your newspaper, The Jackson Advocate?
As I said, this is the 21st time we've either been shot at, shot into, or otherwise assaulted. We didn't stop then. We aren't going to stop now. I think that it is a challenge to all people of goodwill to see that news is dispensed, whether it pinches the comforts. I think nobody can make wise decisions unless they have the information. Euripides said, "This is true freedom when free men speak freely." And that's what we intend to do.
If people want to help rebuild the Jackson Advocate, is there a number that they can call?
Well, they can call, we don't have a phone yet, the number that you're calling, but I would rather them call Ramsey Clark in New York at 212-475-3232.
That's the former U.S. Attorney General. He is your lawyer?
Right. He has been a friend of ours through many of these struggles. And we would like for him to even speak to you about the kinds of assaults that we have had years, and because he's been a part of all of them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck to you and your staff at the Jackson Advocate. When do you plan on coming out with your next paper?
Thursday.
How can you do it?
We're going to work for my home.
Good luck.
Thank you.
And that is Charles Tisdale of the Jackson Advocate. He is the founding publisher and editor. The Jackson Advocate firebombed early yesterday morning. Again, if you'd like that number, if you'd like to help out the Jackson Advocate, the number to call is 212-475-3232. That's 212-475-3232. If you'd like to send us email, you can do it at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Next up, we'll hear from another pioneering voice of a previous generation. We'll hear from the actor, the scholar, the singer, Paul Robeson. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back after stations identify themselves in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're going to continue with another one of those exception to the rulers, this one from a previous generation. Today we're going to hear from Paul Robeson, a man who spoke out through the 1930s and 40s and 50s and 60s, despite the fact that he was blacklisted, that he was placed under debilitating scrutiny by McCarthyism. His famed voice was silenced for long, but his voice is not silenced on Pacifica, and it never was, as you will see in this interview that he did in 1958. The anniversary of his birth, the centennial of his birth, is April 9th of this year. He was born April 9th, 1898. We're now going to play an interview he did in 1958 at Pacifica's founding station, KPFA, with the news director there, Elsa Knight Thompson.
I have in the studio with me Paul Robeson, who needs no introduction, and Harold Winkler, who is president of Pacifica Foundation, which operates KPFA, as most of you know. Mr. Robeson has been known and loved as an artist all over the world for many years, but he has also, I believe, attracted considerable and worldwide attention in his role as a world citizen and as a person who was very deeply concerned about the society in which he lived. I wonder, Mr. Robeson, if we could kick off by asking, when did you first become involved in the political aspects of...
May I first say how happy I am and privileged to be with you here, and how deeply I thank this station for its kindness throughout the years. I've been on two or three others this time, but always have been, know I've had a welcome here, so I want to thank you. I would say, as I indicate in a recent book which is now out, it will be on the stands pretty soon, Here I Stand, Story of My Life as I Tell It, not too autobiographical. It began when I was a little boy in Princeton, New Jersey. Strange to say. Technically, this is the shaping of my views, a Negro boy born in Princeton, New Jersey, in a college town where the students mainly came from the Deep South. You know, Princeton, and Princeton, Harvard, and Yale was the sort of the Southern University of the North, whether you know that or not. And so I grew up in Jersey in a rather Southern atmosphere, and my father was a minister, and I was shaped against that background. Technically, I entered the sort of the arena in the United States of fighting for social justice for my people in a concert, when I was in a concert in St. Louis in 1947, in the Post-Dispatch, where I was singing at the Kiel Auditorium, one of the big auditoriums there, and the NAACP asked me in St. Louis at that time to come on a picket line because Negro people could not even sit in the theater, which was just across the street. And so I grabbed a banner, and lo and behold, I saw Walter Houston coming down the street. He was in the play. So Walter walked out and joined the picket line, too. And a few nights later, when I was doing the concert, I said that I could not quite resolve the contradiction between singing to an audience in St. Louis, where there was no segregation, of course, but also the same people had not, to my mind, were not fighting to see that my people could sit in the theater. It's been corrected since. And so I said that I was giving up my career technically for the moment to enter the realm of the day-to-day struggle of the Negro people especially.
And this was your first political action?
That was within this context. This is very important to get into context. My first actual, to come back to your question, was in London in 1933. It isn't very well known, which I clarify in the book, that I went to play Showboat in London in 1928. Jerry Kern was with me and Oscar Hammerstein, and we had a great success. And then I did concerts in 1928, and I became domiciled and lived in England, domiciled there, paid my taxes there from 1928 until 1940, after the war began.
Does this mean, Mr. Robeson, that you spent most of your time in England during this period?
It meant that I came back now and then for concerts. I was here in Oakland many times, but I went back and spent most of my time in Great Britain.
That's perfectly true.
I was there in 1930, played Othello. So again, this is extremely important. At that time, I said for the public to see that I felt... I would explain it today in this light. We understand why many of my people have come to Oakland, to the vicinity, from Mississippi and from the South. There have been migrations into California, I understand, today from everywhere. But for many years, as you know, many of my people have left the South because the conditions in the North were better. Okay? I felt the pressure so much in 1928 that instead of stopping in New York, I just went on to London. That clear.
And did you feel no pressure there in the racial sense?
I felt nowhere near the pressure. Now, that does not mean that you haven't the background of the English colonies and so forth.
Yes,
but
I wonder.
But I say it's a difference between right here now and, say, let's say, the Mississippi of Mr. Eastland. You understand?
Yes.
This is quite different. So America's quite different. There are great differences. So I found England that much more of a difference, that's all. Mm. I found Canada that way. When I was playing Othello some years ago, when we got to Toronto, the cast said to me after a week, well, Paul, why are you so different? The play is much deeper. You seem to be freer. I said, that's quite true. That's quite true. I'm in a country this is not a question. I'm on a theater, on a stage with many other white actors. This is not a problem here. So obviously I feel freer. That's right. I'm in a different... I don't... feel the pressures that one would feel in the Deep South all the time, but it would interest you to know, and I've put it, that I feel any Negro, if he were honest, would have to say that even in our democracy as at present, that he is never any one second unconscious of the fact that he is a black American or a colored American. He can never be unconscious of it in any part of the United States.
Mr. Robeson, have you been back to England since the last war?
Oh, yes, I was back in 49.
The point I wanted to get at is that when I was in England last year, I became aware of the large number of West Indians who are now London, and I heard rather nasty overtones in my talks with some Englishmen that frightened me.
No question
about a change that might take place in England.
No, I, again, if you want to go further into nothing could be worse than South Africa. And I'm only saying, I put these things down. What is most important is that at the height, having lived many years out, and enjoying the height of success in Great Britain, that I decided that I must come back to my own country to struggle in this and to make the sacrifices that I have. That's the most important thing in this regard. And I am here.
Now, wait, would you spell this out again for me? You left England because England is not as attractive or because you feel you have a greater mission in the United States?
No. Let's don't get in that. There are many places in the world where, personally, it would be much easier to live than in the United States for an American Negro.
In other words, your commitment is definitely to what you feel you can do in this country.
That's right. And Langston Hughes, in a book discussion before the book club in New York just a while ago, pointed out that every important Negro novelist, not only Richard Wright, but many others, that the great 95% of them live in Paris or somewhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the pressures personally are much simpler.
And yet, in the foreword of your book that I have before me, you quote Frederick Douglass as saying, "A man is worked on by what he works on."
That's right.
"He may carve out his circumstances, but his circumstances will carve him out as well."
That's right.
Is this part of the reason why you feel that you must be back in the United States?
I made the decision some years ago, and I say certainly that I spring essentially from here. Like you threw the other day about the Indians in North Carolina. If you recall, that was in Robeson County.
Yes, I noticed that in the item.
Now, this is a very interesting thing which I point out in my book and which explains a good deal, too, of how I feel. Now, I was born on the edge of Robeson County, and my father is a Robeson and was a Robeson because he was a slave, my own father, a slave of the Scottish Robesons who still control Robeson County in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I approach these problems from a very close point. But I have a home, and my people are tobacco workers and sharecroppers today on plantations in that county. But a part of that soil belongs to me. That's my roots. These are my roots in this country. On the other hand, also, I felt that... somewhere, the contributions that I had... could make some contribution from my background traveling about the world. However, I never expected, I am quite willing to say, that I would be restricted from traveling.
Yes.
Well, tell me, Mr. Robeson, was your commitment to the political scene then largely as a result of your feeling about your own people, or our own people, let's put it?
Yeah.
Or did it have other overtones of political conviction?
First it starts as an American Negro interested in my own people. The other great change is very constant in my mind. I was in the Welsh Valley. And the Welsh people sing very much like we do in the Negro people.
Yes, I've heard
many
them.
Of our songs, beautiful songs. And I was one of the few outsiders who has sung at a Welsh Eisteddfod, their national festival which has gone on since the time of the Druids. And I went down in the mines with the workers, and they explained to me that, "Paul, you may be successful here in England, but your people suffer like ours. We are poor people, and you belong to us. You don't belong to the bigwigs here in this country." And so I today feel as much at home in the Welsh Valley as I would in my own Negro section, any city in the United States. And I just did a broadcast by transatlantic cable to the Welsh Valley a few weeks ago. And here was the first understanding that the struggle of the Negro people, or of any people, cannot be by itself. That it is a human struggle. And so I was attracted then met many members of the Labour Party, and my politics embraced also the common struggle of all oppressed peoples, including especially the working masses, specifically the laboring people of all the world. And that defines my philosophy. It's a joining one of, we are a working people, a laboring people, the Negro people. and there is a unity between our struggle and those of white workers. In the South, I've had white workers shake my hand and say, Paul, we are fighting for the same thing. And so this defines my attitude toward socialism and toward many other things in the world. I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership in the interest of all.
Is that a democratic socialism, or...?
I would have to be a democratic socialism. There are many ways, however, to struggle toward democracy, as I see that in a place like China, for example, today, the Soviet Union, many other places, or take our own problems of Negroes. If we were free in the South tomorrow to carry our weight, to vote into everything, would we now look around and try to find the 10 billionaires among our people? Would we attempt to build them up, or would we try to answer the needs of the great millions of our people? And so I see other ways of life, socialism, as trying to solve the problems of millions and tens of millions of peoples at once, in a way, instead of we would start from the individual to the masses, they start from the masses this way. Now, there are two ways, and there are difficulties each way. I have made the decision to join in a collective struggle, and the reason that my personal sacrifices mean very little in the struggle, in one way, when you see the children at Little Rock, what does not giving a few concerts mean, if you can make some other contribution? It's in that context. So nothing is perfect in the world. We're going toward it from different angles. I feel there's a great burden of proof on every society, on our own as well, today.
On our own as well. Mr. Robeson, some years ago, I was talking to a French member of the Communist Party.
Yes.
And in the course of our discussion, he said to me, you, Mr. Winkler, are a Jeffersonian Democrat.
Yes.
You can afford it in your rich land. Yes. But in my land and in other lands, we must give up our freedom now to certain men in order to achieve freedom for our children in the future. This is an act of faith for me, he said, mm-hmm. giving up my mm-hmm. freedom now. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself sympathetic with...
I don't think that is... I would put it quite differently. No, nor do I think that's any part of any socialist philosophy or communist philosophy, as far as I know, that we struck it during the war under Roosevelt, for example. We had to give up many privileges. They're practically telling us we have to do that again. I mean, in any sort of a war economy, in England, for example, they have not eaten eggs almost for years and years because of certain pressures. And it seems to me in the socialist lands, the Soviet Union, China, and many places, that that's quite true. It's one thing to say today that they don't have as shining apparel as we do, but they have made tremendous scientific progress. And within one generation, so to speak, within 40 years, have become one of the most powerful countries in the world. Now, they've done it by great sacrifices, and not by, to my mind, they feel that the country, in one sense, the man in the street, may not in every essence belong to him, but he feels it's much more his than, say, I do in Charleston, South Carolina, when one Southern American Negro explained to me that I was in the state of our great plantations. I said, are you sure about that, our great plantations? I don't feel that they're my plantations. But in one sense, some of the people in the socialist lands feel that the country does belong to them in a real sense. Now, there are, and as far as the basic concept of the dictatorship of the proletariat and so forth, I would say, again, bring it back to our own history. There was, as we know, a dictatorship of the North over the South in the days following the Civil War. When that dictatorship was removed, the colored people reverted practically into a kind of servitude. I could have conceived of a dictatorship over the South for quite a longer period, from my point of view, quite frankly. So this is understandable.
Yes. In your book, Mr. Robeson, Here I Stand, you have a chapter entitled The Power of Negro Action.
That's right.
What are some of the specific acts which you recommend, and perhaps in the order of priority? Yeah.
Well, I say in any Negro life, you would say that nobody, this is, seems to be rather startling to many of my friends. Nobody would be startled, say, with taking the vote, the power of Italian action, or Polish action in Detroit, or Catholic action in New York, and so forth. I mean, that the vote would be a block, and the power of the Negro vote in the North in certain states. This is one very important aspect. Very clear, a kind of we have tremendous economic power in this land today. There should be tremendous support of Negro business, of Negro banks and so forth, loan associations and so forth. But the prime thing is that I'm convinced that... Yes.
Taking this last illustration of yours, have you not found that as Negro bankers become richer, that they grow away from your people?
No, I don't. I know
do they remain a part of total Negro action?
There's no way for, as I said before, for any American Negro, however wealthy, however famous, to be anything at this period of our history at some point than an American Negro.
If he doesn't know it,
he'll find it out.
From a racial standpoint, Mr. Robeson, but from the political standpoint of socialism, which you were discussing a few moments ago, surely a Negro capitalist, if he had the opportunity, would undoubtedly behave according to the lights of his own
He has to, but
business.
But I know many of the most wealthy, and they often I feel that they don't help as much as they should. But he's forever conscious his children suffer the same things as the poor Negro's children. And at some point, he finds a way to help. Mm-hmm. It's a little different even there. But that is...
In other words, you feel it tracks through in a different way.
But I'm really not... what I'm trying to say is that somewhere for our own dignity, I see, that is Africa, would you understand, Ghana today, unifying as with its own sort of, nationalist strength. Is that clear?
Yes. Yeah.
I feel in America, strange to say, especially in the South, that even with all the goodwill of white liberals in the country, that it's very important for the Negro people to know what they want and to unify to do it. Often in a very simple case of fighting segregation, one group of Negroes can be drawn aside because of political pressure, other pressures. We should unify, too. We should unify.
Yes,
I feel there's got to be a unity in order to integrate. That's what I feel. I feel that we just can't integrate as individuals.
Yes. But isn't the example of Liberia, for example, a sorry example against Ghana?
Well, yes, because that's a very simple. Firestone has taken care of that. It has been exploited to its hilt by Firestone rubber, if you don't know the facts.
Yes, right. It still remains, then,
right.
An economic
and
question.
And so has Ghana.
Than a racial unity question. It remains an economic question its fundamentals rather than the unity of the Negro people.
Ghana has the unity of its own nation, same as Chinese or Indians, very close to India. India's just, they have a culture and a history that has its own national characteristics.
But what will prevent Ghana from becoming another Liberia?
That's the...
What do you mean?
Well, from because
Liberia
of the
today
pressures.
Is completely controlled by Firestone, not by Africans. But I feel that Nkrumah is going to control the economy of Ghana, and at some time.
And you're listening to Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson, an interview 30 years ago in 1958, when he was not silenced on Pacifica's first station, KPFA. We're going to go back to this interview in just a minute. He's being interviewed by KPFA News Director Ilse Knight Thompson and the president of the Pacifica Foundation, Harry Winkler. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Trouble I've seen, nobody knows my sorrow. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Glory, hallelujah. Sometimes I'm up, sometimes I'm down, oh yes, Lord. Sometimes I'm almost to the ground, oh yes, Lord. Oh, nobody.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the interview done 30 years ago in 1958 at Pacifica's founding station in Berkeley, California, KPFA, with the news director there, Ilse Knight Thompson, and the Pacifica Foundation president, Harry Winkler. After that, you're going to hear a speech that Paul Robeson did in 1957, along with some of his music.
And at some time be strong enough to say to the European, either you sit here and acknowledge that we run our own country, like Nehru, or else you go. But I don't see the day when Liberia can tell Firestone to do that. Oh, they're quite different. They're quite different. Liberia is a complete vassal state of American capital, finance capital, without question. They have nothing to say. Nothing whatsoever.
What is your reaction to the passive resistance as practiced in Montgomery?
I think there was a magnificent movement, and nobody can, I say, there's nothing, as far as the general thing of a nonviolent solution of the problem, this is the, there could be no other solution within our, within the frame of things today. I mean, this is a very important contribution. Nobody could think of a violent solution unless the Negroes, unless somebody wanted to ask somebody to be destroyed. I mean, that would be absurd. On the other hand, within that framework, I think that the Negro people have to be extremely militant and demand a little more than they are demanding today, and to do a little more, not to do, to do other things as well as pray, let me put it, as well as pray.
Do you think there's been a change in the attitude of the Negro churches toward militant political and economic action, Mr. Rhodes?
I think there has, because it's history, you know. Take Frederick Douglass. I belong to the AME Zion Church. There is one in this area. And Douglass was a part of that church. Harriet Tubman, who formed the Underground Railroad, who was called the Moses of our people. They sang Go Down Moses when she came into the South to free the slaves. And Harriet Tubman. And we have a tradition of tremendous... consistent speaking out, you know, for our rights, like in the whole civil rights struggle. I mean by militant, letting people know that you want to be free like anybody else. And I think the churches, however, a lot of the responsibility still rests upon our churches, because that's where so many of our people, you know, go. They have tremendous influence still.
Mr. Robeson, do you think your artistry as a singer and actor have suffered because of your involvement in political action, or profited?
They have not. I feel that they have profited. They've only suffered when they've suffered by the fact that because of my political views, which I certainly did not expect in a democracy, that I've been prevented from exercising my craft. However, I've kept singing all through the years. You may be able to test it pretty soon. I just made a recording the other day for Vanguard, which they felt was superior to any records I have ever made. My voice is still in fine shape. I've been in the area. And as far as Othello, I've worked on it. I feel I've just been invited to play at Stratford-on-Avon, the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre in England, in, strange to say, in Pericles, to play the part of Gower. And I would certainly do Othello at some point in London, and I feel I would give a better performance. I feel that in every, and I've got a lot of things here which we won't be able to get to in my music, comparing the folk music of the world, I would say that my interest in my art has deepened just no end in the last years. And I become interested in the music of Bartok, of Mussorgsky, many folk things, the unity of the folk music of the world, which has sprung from my political conviction that all people should be unified. I have seen it expressed in their music, and I do a program, which of all the songs of all the peoples in the world, suggesting that we are all one human family. It all comes to that. So I feel that basically, that it has deepened my... On the other hand, I have never separated my work as an artist from my work as a human being. I've always put it even more strongly that, to me, my art is always a weapon. It's got to be good art. Othello was a weapon in racial relations, or at least showing that we can do some things too. I played football. My father explained to me that, well, a fella hit me, I couldn't hit him back because they'd say we were bad and savage, so I had to stand and be knocked all around. I had to do well in my studies. So I've never been able to divorce one thing from the other. And luckily, I don't sing the kind of songs that you're here and you hit the high, whatever it is, the high B flat and the high this and the high that. I sing songs that express very much the emotions of different peoples, like the Welsh, the Scotch, the Negro, Chinese, Russian, and so forth.
Well, what is the present state of play on this passport business? You were talking about your British invitations.
Yes.
How are you going to get there?
Well, luckily, I think at this point, the basic case is before the Supreme Court. It's the case of Rockwell Kent, contending that all the cases revolve around, that when the State Department put in its administrative necessities that one sign a non-communist affidavit, whether or not he is, was, or so forth, that this is a violation of constitutional rights. wasn't just any American now has to sign this this particular proposal. And this is before the Supreme Court. And in its present temper, it seems to me that the court might easily decide.
And this is what you refuse to do. You refuse to sign such a document.
Oh, yeah, completely refuse. This is a complete invitation. Did you murder your wife yesterday or the day before? Are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? This is no, but my political opinions are my own business, you know. This is a complete, and I say we have the background of the reversal in the Smith Act cases all over this country. So somebody was framed, I would say. So it shows that all of it, to my mind, is a complete hoax from somewhere.
In other words, you're hoping that on the basis of some of the current court decisions that you may get your passport in time to go
Yes, or I have now been invited to sing on April 6th in a national television broadcast. Maybe I could get special permission to go. I mean, and because of my background in England, there is almost a national, almost demand from England or request that I be allowed to come in April and even before the summer. And also, I take some optimistic point of view from the fact that where no passports are needed, after restricting me for many years, even in that area, this had to be lifted because the courts would certainly, I think, have ruled that this was completely illegal once I was stopped from going to Hawaii, Puerto Rico, which are parts of the United States. So I can now go anywhere in this hemisphere.
Oh, you're not dangerous as long as you stick to the Western Hemisphere.
I'm just saying, but if a court is looking at this, how can the State Department argue that if I leave the country, this is extremely dangerous? The guy, he got up in court, the fellow, and if I left, it was going to be a catastrophe. I don't know what would happen the next morning, immediately I got on the plane. But I can now be in Brazil, I can be in the West Indies, I can be in Canada, I can be anywhere in this hemisphere. Why can't I be in London? It doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. So I'm optimistic that I may get my passport.
Mr. Robeson, if we may change
Yes,
the
I'd like to
direction.
Get to my concert.
could I, however, ask you some questions along another line for a moment? I have three small children of my own, and I'm very much interested in the problems of children with relation to the larger problems.
There is a balm in Gilead to make the wound. Sin-sick soul. Sometimes I feel discouraged and think my work's in vain, and then the Holy Spirit revives my soul again.
At this time, it is my delight and pleasure to welcome back again our friend Paul Robeson, who has had so warm and cordial an interest in this church and specifically in our legislation struggle and our litigation struggle regarding the test oath. I'm glad he's here anytime, but especially in a week when the Supreme Court gave us the next step to take. And so I do most joyously present to you Paul Robeson.
I know I need not stress what a privilege and joy it is to be with you this morning and to hear a friend from New York, Mr. Williams, one of our distinguished musicians, sing to us. I hope to come again sometime and hear the choir I feel so close to, and to come on this Sunday when this good news has come, because we know today that in the temper of our country, and with an understanding of what our Constitution means in many fields, it certainly seems very reasonable to assume that the victory for the church will be won. And I haven't seen you for some time, and I see from the subject integration touches on many things that have happened since I've been away just a few months ago. Well, I remember a friend gave me a poem of the song that you all know, that certainly, as I was looking at it this morning and thinking of the
now to get before the Supreme Court. It has a lot of more meaning, and I shall at some time certainly use the song Gospel Liberty. We read of a people in ages long past who wished their neighbors no ill, yet were persecuted and daily harassed and driven from mountain to hill. These innocent souls had no lawful defense, but we have. But if persecutors now say, abandon your faith or we'll banish you hence, in reason we answer them, nay, nay. In reason we answer them, nay. If all the transactions in heaven and earth for almost these 2,000 years have been to give virtuous liberty birth, how solid her standing appears. Then come ye afflicted and scattered abroad. You ask if in peace you may stay from all the extensive dominions of God. The answer is pointedly, yea. And hearing my dear friend Reverend Fritchman speak this morning, I sort of feel, too, that I've come to a sort of a refuge. I often talk to my wife, Essie, at home. Once in a while, your pastor sends us a sermon like he preached this morning, especially when it refers to a matter which is close to his heart, too, the struggles of my people and of other peoples in this land, of all Americans. And we often sit and talk about him with deep affection and talk about you with deep affection. Certainly I do. I have been interviewed in many forms and so forth, even since I've seen you. But many things have changed, and they change every day. And I come back to California singing up north and singing here last night, and with almost a whole life revivified here in California. Makes sense? You are fast becoming the center of our land. But I know you would like to know, since this beginning had so much to do with my concerts in your church, that now I've been able to sing up north. I was in Sacramento the other night. I go back to Stockton to sing in the auditoriums, in the public auditoriums, and in the public schools of Stockton, Sacramento, up north. Now I understand things in Los Angeles, and I'm about to play Othello next spring in San Francisco and hope to be able to come here. So it is in a very personal sense this morning that I can discuss these things relating to integration in a special sense, but to we in which we live. Most of us were born, and I sort of feel as I do in my brother's church or in my father's church of the Methodist, the AME Zion. I come from Methodist Church, and I studied for the ministry for 2 years, as a matter of fact, at Rutgers. And I used to come home to see my father in Somerville, which sits nestled in the hills of central New Jersey. And I would come back and say, well, Pop, I'm down school, I'm working in philosophy, you know, and I'm struggling with Schopenhauer and these fellows, and they disagree with you a great deal, you know. They And so he would listen. He said, tell me all about it. That's right. And yes, fine. Now, son, I don't feel so well this Sunday morning, and will you take the pulpit for me? And so I would take the pulpit and speak a while, and then afterward the singing of the church. And so I'd do that for a few Sundays, and then somewhere in the spring there would be a revival meeting. And one of our great preachers would come, and I mean great preachers, like Moody and Sankey and you know, the sort of the real fire and thunder approach to things. And sort of like the old prophets of the Old Testament. And I know my father would I'd be sitting in the front row, and somewhere in the middle of that revival meeting, this minister would leave the platform, and he would go around talking about the sinners, and how they did this, that's those that drank, and those that did, and these sinners who deal with the philosophies that are against the ideas of God. And then he would get right down on the corner and concentrate on me. And then they'd start the singing, and the sisters would move all around, and all right around me. And I am willing to concede that many a time have I been converted in my brother's church, over and over again. But again, in that not quite like it seems. It meant a collective life. There we gathered, as I've heard one of our pastors say many times, that somewhere in the week of labor, hard labor, in the week of insult, in the week of living somehow at times as you feel in an alien society where nobody stretches out a hand, that somewhere when you walk in your church on Sunday morning in Negro life in this country, there, this is our home.
You've been listening to Paul Robeson in speech and interview and in song here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee-Soo Koo and Dan Coughlin. Our engineer is Errol Maitland. Our executive producer, Julie Drizin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
You jagger diamonds, now you jagger.